Welcome back to the Bible in Context. We're back for the rest of chapter 18 this time.
Good to be back again.
Well, let's go ahead and dive into it. We had an abrupt cutoff last week, so let's just get going with it.
Yeah, so where did we leave off?
Yeah, so Yahweh had just come to Abram with, or Abraham, I keep doing that, with a couple of other spiritual beings with him, and they're coming to see if the wickedness of Sodom is actually as bad as what Yahweh has heard. We're not told who's told him, whether it's through prayers or, you know, in like Zechariah, we see the eyes of the Lord going around observing the earth. It's kind of a whole different rabbit hole. But anyway, Yahweh has heard a report that this city is really bad. So he's going to go check it out and see. And so he has talked to his two angelic buddies and said, should we tell Abraham about this too? I mean, after all, he's going to be king of the earth. So let's go ahead and let him in on our plan as we govern the earth.
And this is concerning to Abraham because his nephew's there.
Right, yeah. Naturally, yeah. His family's there. He wants to protect him. So he's going to spend a few minutes trying to save his family, save his nephew, and just assure that Yahweh is being righteous in what he's doing, which is it's an interesting concept to us. He's having a very human conversation with Yahweh, just making sure that he is going to be just. Maybe this is a tangent. Maybe it's worth having. I don't know. You can stop me if this is off.
I think it's right there. I mean, he asks the question, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked?
Right. And we as moderners, and maybe we'll get into this one day, but I think this is because of our rich and skewed philosophical traditions, that we have this idea of God being perfect in certain ways, which you have to realize off the bat that we have chosen certain ways in which to perfect God, where we say he is perfect in righteousness, but for us it would be a totally foreign and weird and kind of wrong statement to say he is perfect in taste. Is Yahweh perfect in the sense that he knows how to give justice in the utmost way, or is he perfect in the sense that he tastes like the best ham sandwich if you were to take a bite out of him?
Okay.
You know, in what ways is he perfect?
Right.
You have
right,
to be
right,
selective.
Right.
And so we've selected different ways throughout our philosophical traditions in ways that we perfect the highest being. In the Bible and the ancient Near East, they perfect Yahweh in different ways. He is perfect in righteousness. We're going to see that. But that wasn't an assumption of ancient Near Eastern gods. Mm-hmm. They were often very capricious and just did things because they felt like it on a whim, or they may not have even told you why they're upset. So Abraham here, he asks for his context a perfectly legitimate question that we should be thankful he asked. Are you a righteous God? And now, because he asked this question, we can affirm yes.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the purpose of this story is to highlight the righteousness of Yahweh, that he's not one of these gods who is finicky and prone to just go off the handle.
Right. So, I mean, we kind of got ahead of ourselves in a bit of a tangent that might be confusing. I hope not. But let's go ahead and actually get into this little paragraph where he starts talking to Yahweh and interceding and kind of get into the question of Yahweh's righteousness.
So he starts off by asking the question, suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you then sweep away the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous who are in it?
Right. And I do love throughout this, he keeps saying like, I'm sorry, can I just say one more thing?
Sure.
Like, you know, forgive me, can I just say one more? Like,
Yeah. Sure, go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, like Abraham keeps doing that, showing this reverence and concern for his respect towards Yahweh and his attention.
Yeah, I think you see Abraham recognizes that he is on, I don't want to say shaky ground, but I mean, this is, like, you don't typically talk this way to a deity.
Right.
And I think Abraham recognizes that, but he definitely pushes the limits here, I think. And, okay, how can I talk to Yahweh? Again, you see Yahweh's compassion highlighted here.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of that feeling like if you go to talk to somebody, you know, important with short time, you know, I don't know, you go to talk to your boss that's a couple of levels above your bosses or something like that, and you know that they usually don't have the time to talk to your level, and so you go in every time you have to say something else, you might have the thought of like, okay, I'm sorry, can I say one more thing? Like, last thing, let me, you know, you're trying to be respectful of their time and attention.
Right, yeah, you get the same kind of feel going on here.
So Abraham keeps going with this until he gets down to 10 people. If there's 10 righteous in the city, will you spare the whole city for the sake of those 10? And that's what he wants. He's not asking for just keep the few righteous alive. He's saying, if there are this many in the city, will you spare the whole city for their sake? Let them keep their home and livelihood and not destroy any for their sake? Which, I mean, that's a pretty profound thing that he's asking. I kind of wonder if there is a seed of the same thought in Jesus's parable of the weeds and the wheat, where he's saying, you know, don't rip out the weeds and the wheat at the same time, but let them grow up together and they'll be sorted out later. That could be way off, but that's what Abraham is asking here. Let the righteous and the wicked grow up together if there's enough righteous.
Right.
Ultimately, Yahweh, yeah, he agrees to, yeah, if there's 10 there, I'll just leave the whole city alone. I won't destroy it. So does it bother you that he doesn't get down to one person?
I had thought about that. I mean, it doesn't give you any kind of reason why. Is there some kind of cultural thing going on there that I don't know about?
I think there's an explanation here. And we'll probably see it as we continue. Maybe we'll mention it in a few minutes. But the other side of that question that I wanted to ask too, and this is one that I think might offend some of our American sensibilities, is why does he want all these wicked people to live if there are no righteous in the city or so few?
I mean, I always took it as he's just trying to save his nephew.
He is. Yeah. So, well, I guess here's the answer to what we were talking about a second ago with why he doesn't get down to one. We get into the city later and we see that there's not 10 righteous.
No.
There's one.
One. There's only
and
one.
So there's so few at that point that they say, look, you and your household, you can get out. I'm not saving the whole city for your sake. I'm going to save you. I'm separating the wheat from the weeds here.
Gotcha.
And then striking down. So the idea is, I guess if there's few enough, then we'll just take them out of the city and then destroy it.
Right.
But not destroy the lives or the livelihoods and homes of this many righteous. And so if rescuing the righteous out of the city was an option, why does Abraham want to leave all these wicked people there if they're as bad as they are in the story?
Right. Why couldn't he rescue 50 out of the city?
Yeah.
Rather than 10. But I think he's probably asking these questions because he's genuinely wondering, are you a righteous God? How gracious are you? It highlights God's righteousness in the midst of a very wicked city, God's willingness to allow wickedness to a point, but there is a point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, whenever creation begins to devolve back into the tohu vavohu, the chaos that he pulled it out of, the project needs to be restarted in a sense in some locations. And Abram's assumption here the whole time is up in verse 25, he's like, are you going to put the righteous to death with the wicked? So he's not assuming that there's going to be any kind of exodus. He's just assuming that everyone in the city, righteous or unrighteous, are going to die. And he's trying to prevent that because he thinks that Yahweh might do it.
Right.
He's not going to, though, because, I mean, we find one righteous person in the city. And Yahweh could say, it's just one righteous person. It's just one righteous person. We can let him die with the rest. But Yahweh stops, sends people in, and gets him out.
Yeah. And you actually do have some hints towards the Exodus here back in verse 21, where he talks about, I'm going to go down to see what they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me. And so that's very similar to what we see in Exodus chapter 2.
Yeah. Yeah. The Israelites are outcrying under their slavery. I think it's the same word there. I'll have to double check that. And we'll talk about that when we recap the Exodus here. Yeah. And then, you know, we talked about as well that throughout the Exodus events, Yahweh comes to know or sees or hears something about the oppression of the people. First,
it ignites his compassion, and his compassion always ends with action. It's not just a feeling that he has, but it's something that moves him.
Right.
Okay, so this brings us to the beginning of chapter 19, where we have again the two angels. If you recall, there were actually three men that visited Abraham. I'm doing the same thing you did, Abraham, at the beginning of chapter 18, and then two of them. So the men turned from there and went towards Sodom, but Abram still stood before the Lord. Okay, and then you go down to chapter 19, verse 1. The two angels, so it doesn't call them men anymore, it calls them angels, came to Sodom. So now we're finally, it's revealed who they truly are. And so you've got Yahweh with two angels.
Well, they are Melechim, they're messengers. And so that could still be technically like human messengers.
That's true.
Still, the point is, like, there are two, there were three men, and Yahweh is somewhere in the mix. Two leave, and there's one left, and that's still Yahweh. So Yahweh is one of these guys.
Right.
And which means these guys are spiritual beings. So when it says Melakim, it probably is referring to spiritual beings.
I was going to say, the fact that they're with Yahweh, and they just kind of appear out of nowhere to Abraham, I think the translation is right here to say angels.
Yeah, and they're part of his little scouting cohort.
Right.
Like Divine Council spy team here.
Right. So we're with the two angels that have come to Sodom right now. And notice there's a timestamp again. It's not in the heat of the day. This time it's
in the evening,
which sounds a little bit more... Nothing good happens in the evening.
Yeah, no, not in the Exodus cycles. Okay, so as we go through this, I failed to go through here and look at all the different timestamps throughout this. But I think that's... So we start out with the sun up, Yahweh appears. It gets evening, things gets bad, just like it does during any Exodus event. And then sun rises as Lot comes out. So that's the reason for the timestamps.
Right.
It's marking, okay, Yahweh has appeared, sun's up, I think, so it's good. Evening, so things are starting to get bad, starting to look bad. And then it's nighttime, destruction, and then sun rises after the destruction. Lot is saved. So it's thematic.
You get the cycle. Yeah, the thematic cycle there. And so when Lot was sitting at the gate of Sodom, now what's the significance of that, that he's at the gate? What does that mean?
Yeah, so in this culture, there'd be judges, elders of the town, that are tasked with hearing out cases and keeping righteousness. And so that's where they would sit, is the gate of the city, because that's where everybody's going to find them. You see this in Ruth, for example. I think Boaz, he's one of these guys who sits at the gate, and... It could just be coincidental that Lot is here, but this could be signaling to us that Lot is righteous. He's a judge of this city. He's a foreigner, and he's a judge of this city.
Right. He's won the respect of the community in some way.
Right. Or maybe he's just the only guy to take on the task.
That could be too, because they're all wicked, and nobody wants to do it. So he's like, all right, I'll do it.
Right. And later, that's kind of what they say. In verse 9 of chapter 19, this fellow came to sojourn, and he has become the judge.
Ah, there you go.
So that may be a callback to verse 2 here, or verse 1, where he's at the gate.
Yeah. Now, they're saying that in derision, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. It could be just referring to that specific scene where he's telling them what to do, but it's still just kind of pointing to the fact of like, okay, Lot is somehow a standard of righteousness in this community.
Right, which is sad.
Yeah, right.
So, but, well, in the New Testament, though, Lot is described as a righteous man, but I think it's only in comparison to everybody else that's around him.
Well, I think the reason for that may be as well that, yes, he takes a very bad tact in the way that he tries to rescue these men, in the way that actually sacrifices his daughters, but he is showing loyalty to Yahweh's servants. And so he maintains right relationship with Yahweh and his kingdom in this story, even though he goes about doing it in a horrible way.
Right.
So
it's
essentially saying, like, look, when it comes to your loyalty to the king of the universe, that's not in question.
Right.
It's just the way you go about it that's
bad. So. Well, and you see his obedience in the fact that he, unlike his wife, does not look back, and he's obedient to Yahweh in that situation.
Yeah, he flip-flops back and forth throughout this story.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that more as we go. But overall, he listened to Yahweh. He obeyed him. He came out of the city, even though he had a lot of mistakes along the way. I mean, that's all of our story anyway. So
absolutely. And I think it's good to, again, say that we see throughout Scripture that somebody who's counted righteous doesn't mean that they're perfect or their faith was perfect or that they do everything in obedience to the Lord, but what it means is they have a right relationship with Yahweh because they've maintained their allegiance to Yahweh.
Right. Yeah, when you look at the span of their life, at the end of it, where do they stand?
Yeah, and I think you've put it really well before when we've had conversations that it's a lot like marriage. I mean, if you're married, you're going to mess up, you're going to do stupid stuff. If you're a guy, you do it all the time. but you stay married because you remain faithful to your spouse. And it's not that you've been perfect to each other, but you remain faithful.
Yeah, it's not like you, I mean, if you're doing this, don't. Where you're taking little snapshots of your marriage and saying, like, you're disloyal in this moment and you're loyal in this moment. You're disloyal in this moment and just nitpicking every action. That is not the way that the Yahweh operates. He looks on the whole and says, like, you know, yeah, we fought this at this point, this point, this point, but we have a good marriage.
Right.
That, yeah. Yeah, so we have Righteous Lot here who is in the gate, and he sees these two guys coming, and we're not really told that he knows that they are Yahweh's messengers, that they belong to him. I think the text is just saying here that he sees two strangers coming up, and he knows how this town is, and so he's like, look, come stay at my place. No, I'm okay. We don't need to. Yes, you do. Come to my house tonight. So he's showing hospitality and trying to protect these guys.
And he does have the same, or at least a similar response as Abraham, in the sense that he bows himself with his face to the earth. Abraham had that same response.
And he starts with, my lords.
My lords. Yeah, lords.
And so immediately, the author is trying to compare and contrast Abram and Lot.
Right.
You see Abram's continual fervent response, continual attention to Yahweh, continual righteousness and trust, and even him going on to conversate with the Lord. And so now let's read this story and see how Lot stacks up to that.
Now, here's one difference that I noticed right away is after he says, my lords, he does not say, if I've found favor in your eyes, like Abraham does. He just says, please turn aside. He does use the word please, and so, I mean, that does signify that he's...
Yeah, I think that might point to the fact, like, Lot sees these guys as just your average travelers. He doesn't realize that they are Yahweh's emissaries.
Right.
And still, I think there might be an aspect here where he knows what the people in this town are like, and so he's just saying, like, look, for your own good, please take me up on my offer. And maybe that's why he's so aggressive in his offer.
Yeah.
Because it says he pressed them strongly in verse 3.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, and he does, he offers them water to wash their feet like Abraham did.
A feast and baked unleavened bread.
Yeah, okay, but it's unleavened bread.
Right.
What's the significance there?
Yeah, this is where it really starts calling back to the Passover a little bit. So we'll dive into kind of a recap of the Exodus in this narrative next time. But I just want to point out here that, this is an Exodus event. We're in an evil, wicked city that's oppressive, that has a cry that's risen against it, and Yahweh's coming to see it. And now we have someone baking unleavened bread, and we're about to have fire rain down from the sky. And the word rain is not used again until the Exodus story to talk about the raining hail and fire, which I didn't realize that at first, that came down and destroyed the crops. So this is just all pointing us to the fact that this is kind of Lot's poorer Passover before his Exodus that he's about to have. And he is providing for these men out of his means and showing them hospitality and righteousness before this Exodus scene. After this verse, in verse 4, it starts, the action starts ramping up a little bit. It gets more intense. We'll pick back up there next week and continue talking about the Exodus in this passage.
Sounds good.
All right. See you.